You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
As a startup founder, you're juggling multiple priorities, from the expected, like finding product market fit, to the unexpected, like customer requests for SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification.
But achieving compliance is time consuming, and time spent on it is time away from the needs of the business.
That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one solution for startups to become compliant quickly and build a security foundation with ease.
With a combination of automation, an extensive partner network, and a security marketplace, Vanta provides the necessary tools and expertise for startups to achieve compliance seamlessly, no matter how urgent the needs are and at every phase of growth.
Over 10,000 leading companies, including CipherStash, Handle, and Indebted, trust Vanta to automate compliance so they can focus on growing their business.
Startup customers get 10% off Vanta at dayone.fm/Vanta/first check, or just go to the link in the show notes.
Hey, Maxine, quick question. Do you like birds? And what about cyber? Do you struggle with that?
Birds, yes. Cyber, well, it's complicated. But lucky for us, that's where Galahr Cyber swoops in.
Galahr Cyber is perfect whether you're a founder looking for practical security advice or an investor needing solid risk management for your portcos.
So if you want to secure your business and join a flock that is unlike most security firms, head over to dayone.fm/Galahr for your free conversation with Cole, who can set you off in the right direction.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, I'm Cheryl.
I'm Maxine.
This is First Check, part of Day One, the network dedicated to founders, operators, and investors.
If you want to be a better early stage investor, this is the show for you.
So TLDR, if you don't want to suck at investing, listen up.
Emily's got a really interesting background because she started a computer vision back in the day before AI was a thing, right?
Yeah, like old school AI. I never thought I would say those words. If you asked me this question in 2019, like, would I ever say the word old school AI? But it was old school AI, and that's kind of where she grew up. And now obviously there's been this huge proliferation in AI and new school AI. And I'm so excited to get in with her. Like, what did she learn in old school AI? Like, what is she pulling through into this new generation? How does this accelerate her in her knowledge in AI? And actually, what are some of the heuristics that she actually has to unlearn?
I actually just like cannot keep a straight face when you say old school AI, but let's run with it. She's also another good example of an operator angel. So we can pull some of that in and really get to understand what she's seen over the last several years.
Totally. I'm so excited for this trend in operator angels, by the way. Like, I can't wait to get more of these folks on the show to talk about like how they bring those two expertise in, both investing into companies and bringing that expertise from their operating journey, but vice versa. It's really exciting to see that group be investing more. So can't wait to get in with Emily and get a sense of, yeah, how does she apply it? What's she learning? And where doesn't it work?
Yeah, 100%. Let's get into it.
Let's do it. Emily, we are so excited to have you on the pod today to chat all things early stage, deep tech investing, and also hype cycles, because man, are we in one. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. So excited to be here.
So we ask the same question of every guest when they join us. What is the first thing that you ever invested in?
Okay, so I've listened to a few people on the podcast now who talk about their first investment and that it was real estate. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, that is unheard of now. I don't think we'll hear that in the future. That's for sure.
Yeah, fair.
That's probably true. Wow, that's a crazy thought. And actually quite sad, right? Like, so many of the people who came on and said that, like, that was a material, well, most of them was a material leg up. I think Georgie from Tidal, it was a step down.
She was the only one.
Oh, I listened to hers. Yes, hers was like her return was not good.
But I think that was an outlier.
The poor thing, but Sam's was good.
Sam's was very good. What about yours? Was yours good?
Mine was not real estate. So mine was...
Oh, okay.
That was sort of an aside that I'd heard a lot of people and I was thinking that's never going to be something that people are going to say anymore, I don't think. But I think mine actually is, as cheesy as it sort of sounds, I started investing in myself in my education, and not from a university perspective, actually, from a schooling in general. So I didn't really enjoy school. And in year 10, I got kicked out for non-attendance. And I remember this moment where I was like, huh, I can either go back to school and actually attend, or I can go and get a full-time job. And those were the options that were given to me, essentially by my principal and my mom at the time. And I loved learning, but I didn't like the school environment, I suppose. It just didn't suit me. So anyway, I chose to go back to school. And I think in those last 2 years of school, I missed like 4 days total. And that was unheard of for me. So that was my first real investment in, hey, this is, I do actually want to be here, and I should be here, and I do want to continue learning, and I'll learn in this fashion if this is the way that I have to do it.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
Wow, I love that. Was it just a mindset shift? That seems like such a stark change for you, right?
There's actually data that shows that people who go back to school later in life have a much higher attendance rate, much higher participation rate and engagement rate, because they are making a conscious choice. And there's even data that suggests that kids who do a gap year and then go back to school are also more engaged because they've had time to decompress and they're like actively making a choice that like, okay, this is what I want to do now. So actually that tracks.
Was that what it was like for you, Emily?
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think whilst you're not being forced to do something, almost, you know, it is a real choice that you're making for yourself. And so that probably does track. And the data is, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because, you know, you go to school because you have to go to school and it's mandated by law that you go to school. And then when you have someone sitting there going, well, you can go to school or you don't have to go to school. And it's like, oh, okay. So now I actually have to make a decision because, you know, it's only mandated to a certain point. So then I made the decision. I think that does track with, I really had, high attendance, got good grades, you know, all of the sort of makings of a good student, which I definitely was not before. So yeah, tracks.
That's so fascinating. I so resonate with the feeling of like being really bad at being told what to do. It is a skill I have just not developed. If someone, like, it is so minor, especially like in our household, Laura, my chief of staff, has to deal with this all the time. She'll be like, or in my household, my partner will be like, hey, can you pass me the salt? And everything in my being is like, no. Like, you have a problem. Like, you're lucky you don't work for other people.
Some oppositional defiance there, Maxine.
Oh, that's so great.
I think it's definitely partly that. Yeah.
That's good to know about you. You have to like incept ideas.
Yeah, you have to influence the ideas rather than just say, hey, Maxine, do this.
This is your idea. You really want to pass me the salt.
Yeah, I'm definitely like that. I think that's where it all sort of stems from, really.
Oh, dear. Right. It's just that maybe I tell myself this because it makes myself feel better, but there is some suggestions and quite a lot of research that founders are really bad employees. Like, great founders are really bad employees. You know, being told what to do and being put in constraints just is a really bad way for founders to kind of thrive in life. And then they step out of it and they're like creating their own thing and they just feel so much better. So I tell myself that that's why, but I think probably I'm just stubborn.
No, data suggests that this is,
that, don't worry.
You know, pie charts.
It's an identity I chose. It didn't choose me.
Well, you've chosen the right field then.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. So all three of us are early stage investors. We all invest in pre-seed and seed. And you know, obviously Cheryl and I are constantly pontificating about why that stage is so great and interesting. And I feel like you have a pretty interesting perspective here. So you know, why did you choose pre-seed and seed as your stage for investment? And why do you believe it's a great place to get in and support founders?
Yeah, I think, okay, again, data. I'll start on the data piece. I think it makes sense to invest early for the greatest uplift. It's the largest area of opportunity. That's what the data tells us. I also just love it. Having been a founder myself, I love getting the chance to work with early stage companies. And in those pivotal moments of growth, I know how much it is make or break. And there's this window of time that almost once you get past that sort of Series A, you know, you found product market fit, you're doing quite well, hopefully, you know, you're strategically aligned. You know, obviously things change and move very quickly, but as companies progress deeper into further rounds, a lot of the foundation's already been set. I love working on the foundation piece. So the ideal version of that for me is working with early stage companies where I can make a difference. And also the, you know, the second piece on the data and the great uplift that you get from investing in early stage. It's high risk, but it's high reward.
Yeah, there's a reason that you get the biggest multiple on that very first investment. And I think if you're Maxine and just don't follow on, then you can just say, yeah, we got a 50x multiple on that, sort of that blended average on the follow on. But I think there's also a piece there around like the most exciting moment in a founder's journey is often that like first year where everything is possible and the world is your oyster, and like just playing into that and really like getting to like, I love founder meetings because you have an hour to like be immersed in whatever future the founder thinks exists and can just be a part of that. Do you find that like as you're talking to founders, you are just like really buying into whatever vision they have regardless of how crazy it is?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I love it. I love that everything is possible. Nothing's off the table. There's very few things that are no's. You know, it's so interesting and it's such a fun stage. And yeah, I think, you know, I spoke about those pivotal moments of growth, and that's just, those are those things where it's in that stage. Those are really, it's really, really fun. It's a lot of fun. You can have a lot of fun with it. And I think what I see myself doing, you know, now and in the future is I'm choosing things that I enjoy. And what I really enjoy is that early stage and being part of that growth at early stage. And I've found that that's just what I enjoy. So why not do it if I can?
Absolutely. I mean, like you've been an operator, right? Like,
yeah,
I think having people early on in the journey that get behind you, like not just with empty words, but with their like money and their time. I'll like speak for myself. I remember Dustin Dogno, who was one of our pre-seed investors. Like he probably has been, I won't say single-handedly, but definitely like a huge influence on my venture-backed building career. Because like he saw an opportunity in me and my co-founders actually before I really did. Like it was like him coming in with his background and his credentials that it almost like was a mirror for me that he held up and was like, no, I think you're capable of doing this. But for me it was like, oh, I don't think I'm allowed to swear on this podcast. S word.
Can we swear?
Have we sworn before? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I swear all day long, but you know, I don't know if Adam edits it out. I probably should ask him.
I swear too. I wasn't sure what the, is it PG?
Says who? Our audience is all investors. They swear all day long.
Yeah.
I think that with our audience, they would appreciate this.
Right. I apologize, you know, our editing team in advance if you're going to have to go through and like bleep all of these. Anyway, but I was like, oh shit, like I actually can do this. And like other people are showing me that I can do this. It's like building my confidence. That is so crucial when you're building one of these venture-backed businesses where you're swinging for the fences, right? You are like putting it all on the field to try and create these outcomes. And so I think one of the enormous privileges, I think, for us investing at pre-seed and also at seed is the opportunity to have, like, to show the founders that we see them. We see what they're capable of. We see that they are incredible. And we are behind them to accelerate them. And I think it's much like once you have done all of the work to build a more repeatable business, you found product market fit, you know, the data clearly says like, hey, I can invest a dollar and make two or three or four or five, whatever your, you know, LTV to CAC ratio or any of those things are. The business at that point has been like, no, you can do this because you are doing it. It's currently happening. Right. And like that gets behind you. But in those early stages, when it's just an idea, I think it can be really impactful, especially for first time founders. And I think this is something that the Australian ecosystem is getting better at, but is not yet killer at, like having folks like you, mate, around the table. So you come in early and be like, yeah, we see you and we're going to get behind you and like accelerate you. I think it's so excellent and such a privilege.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's what makes such a huge difference. And I think also the privilege of having that experience of being a founder and being in that position and having empathy for how difficult that journey is, especially at that early stage where you really are putting everything into this thing, right? And you believe in it, but there are definitely days where you are like, I do not believe this works anymore at all. And to be a nice sounding board for founders and to give them confidence, not just with your investment dollars, but with your time. So, you know, if you're giving up your time and spending it with people at that early stage, you're saying, wow, I really believe in what you're doing. Not only have I invested my money, but I will spend time working with you on your pitch or your commercial negotiations or whatever it may be. And those are the types of things at an early stage where I had people in my life that I felt, wow, you really believe in what I'm doing. I don't just believe in what I'm doing. So 100%, it's great that you're not the only one believing in it. And there are these external people saying, this is really good. What you're doing is right. And keep doing it.
It probably also influences the outcome, right? Like if you're hyping someone from the sidelines is like cheering on an athlete. They're probably going to run faster. Or at least I like to think that cheering them on from the sidelines makes them run faster.
Yeah.
100% it does. I have never run a long race, not a runner. But I believe, like, you definitely see them and they're all like, be like, it perks you up, you know, like having your crew around and like celebrating. So I really like that analogy. You know, it's like you are running a marathon at sprint pace. And so like having crew on the sidelines, like they're not on the racetrack with you, but they are there on the sidelines kind of handing you goo or water or whatever. That I think is goo a thing? Definitely not a runner.
Yeah, the goo.
Goo pouches, like the yogurt pouches I give my kid, but they're for adults and they're gooey.
Kind of the same.
Or maybe that was just like a hype product for a while that everyone got excited about.
I think they're still doing it. I don't know.
But speaking of hype products.
Segue,
yes. Speaking of hype products, I think as Maxine said, we're kind of in like the mother of all hype cycles at the moment. Would love to get your sense of like, have you identified, like, how do you identify and navigate hype cycles in the investing world? Like, what have you seen play out?
My favorite one is the metaverse. That's my favorite one. It's because it was so overhyped and no one is spending time in the metaverse yet. I will say yet, because I'm sure that eventually people will
I really thought we were going to like go into like a Ready Player One scenario.
But we're not there, right? And so there was this huge hype for the metaverse. And I don't know if you remember, but brands were starting to begin advertising strategies for the metaverse. Do you remember that?
Yes. And bands as well.
Yeah. And basically no one ever saw their ads because no one was just chilling in the metaverse. So it was this huge overhyped.
But it was really cheap advertising space.
Did you guys ever watch the first ever Shark Tank episode in the US? Not Shark Tank here, Shark Tank in the US.
No, what was it?
What was it?
I'm pretty sure it was the first episode. And this guy pitched it would have been in the early 2000s when everyone was wearing those like head, like earpieces for microphones. Remember those things that looked like cockroaches with like glowing bums that they would put on their ear? So what his pitch was like, you look silly when you wear one of those. So what we should do is we should implant
the iconic ear.
Well, no, he was like, we should implant the microphone and the speaker in the person's ear. So if you call, you just like receive the call in your head and it'll be great. And so you could.
Yeah, it was called the iconic ear.
Oh, wait, are you serious? That's what it was actually called.
What?
I thought you were naming it the iconic ear.
Yeah. I'm telling you, it's called the iconic ear.
Did it work? Did it, like, doesn't exist?
Well, no, so the sharks, like, absolutely tore him apart. And one of the questions was, like, well, wait a second, how does it charge?
Oh, well.
And he was like, it's fine. At nighttime, you just lie down and you insert this pin through your eardrum and charge it.
That seems legit.
And the shark, one of the sharks, I think Damon John was just like, oh, my God.
No, that is not.
Not okay.
That's not it.
Which, like, at the time, he obviously, like, they obviously put it on reality TV because it was, like, a step too far. But, like, at the time, everyone was wearing these, like, headphones.
And Bluetooth devices at the time, like, they were the ones that, like, went over your ear and were, like, this long stick.
Huge.
Yes, they were huge.
Yeah, they were fairly large. So like, I see that where he's like, dumb. You look dumb. Here, stick something in your ear instead.
Agree with the problem, not so much the solution.
And also charge it through a pin.
Yeah, charge it with a pin in your ear. Like, what if you happen to roll while sleeping, like what? Every human on the planet?
What if you missed?
What if you missed? What about if you need to replace it? There's just so many questions.
Can you imagine if that turned into a hype cycle?
Well, no, thank God. No, but I wonder if we're going to watch that video of Zuck, like, launching the metaverse.
Oh, yes, when he goes the metaverse thing and he's like this like robot cartoon character and we're all like
so cringe.
Just so cringe, like the ionic ear.
Like, I wonder if we're going to have a similar moment watching that, you know, in 20 years. Like, business school classes will be playing it and people will just be like, what?
Yeah.
Like, why did they ever think that was going to work?
I'm not convinced about the metaverse yet. But I think that your question was actually, how do you identify and navigate them? And I just went straight into like, hey, the metaverse sucks. And that's not what I meant.
Great answer regardless.
You know, another one that I really couldn't, I'm still not, and I know Cheryl, you know a lot more about blockchain than I do. I know you're more involved. And it's one that I'm still like, aren't you? Did I make that up?
Probably like by this much though. Like, I feel like
I love the cushioning here. I mean, she's just about to be like, I think you invested in hype cycles, but I don't want to like directly target your like, you know, a whole bunch of your investments. So she's like, you know, I think it's fine. Like, it's fine. I'm still learning.
It's fine. You probably know more about it than I do. So like,
go for it. Just go straight for the squishy stuff. You think blockchain is a hype cycle?
Not at all. I think there is like, okay, so blockchain, everyone started spinning up these niche crypto funds and things like that. And that was pretty crazy. But I think there are some really interesting use cases. I really love the use case of, you know, there's basically food tracking and things like that. I can see some really, really nice uses for it. And then there are some very clear just meme stocks that it was like, come on, really? We're really doing this? And then that was so overhyped and it went into this sort of hype cycle. But I think the ultimately how I sort of navigate it is I also own crypto, so I didn't really navigate it. But developing a clear investment hypothesis is probably like the thing, right? I think what people did was because it wasn't in their investment hypothesis, they started spinning up crypto funds because they couldn't invest in crypto in their funds, right? So it was very interesting.
Yeah, the moment crypto went from a currency to an investment product, then like a lot of other dynamics came into play that impacted the potential usefulness of the technology.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think Charlie Munger said, this is probably more a statement of his approach to social striation than anything, but he kind of gives the advice when he was alive that if your shoe shiner starts giving you stock tips, sell. And I had a similar moment.
Sell everything or just the stock that he told you about?
I don't know. That's a good question. I wish I could ask him. I think he was referencing like overall, it says to the market, like you are at the top of a hype cycle, like you're the top of a bubble. And so like you should liquidate. But my moment for that in crypto.
What's the modern day equivalent?
Well, my modern day equivalent in crypto specifically was I was in Austin and someone drove past with a Lamborghini that was covered with the Doge dog, like just like
the Dogecoin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dogecoin. But you know, the dog, like covered.
Yeah.
Repeated all over Lamborghini zoomed past me in Austin. And I was like, if I had crypto, I would be like, I would literally like right now be selling it based on this Lamborghini.
Specifically the Dogecoin. But I just want to say that of all the crypto I bought, and I bought a lot of crypto, Doge had the biggest like multiple, biggest return. I think we got like a 4,000% return on our Doge investment.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy because it was all hyped. And then as long as you sold at the right time, it was fine.
Yeah, well, when you like get a 4,000% return, you're like, yeah, okay, sure. I will. Yeah, I'm going to take that off the table.
Money comes off the table.
Yeah.
I do think the hype cycle question, though, is quite interesting. Like, as investors, right, our job is to invest in what the future looks like. And so we're supposed to, well, in this line of investing and in this asset class, and especially if we're investing in seed and pre-seed, right, is really important and can produce some really incredible returns if you're investing in companies that are before the wave. I think Mike Maples talks about this idea of investing in founders who've seen the future. So they've like worked in companies at the cutting edge of technology, and then they're building infrastructure that we're going to need, or they're building like products that we're going to need at that stage. And so we think the kind of like activity of working out how to spot some of these dynamics to make sure you're not just kind of forward investing ahead of the curve, which I think for our audience, probably worthwhile mentioning, if you're not familiar with the hype cycle, it's worthwhile something to be familiar with. Essentially, you have a new technology. The technology sparks a like building in sentiment of the belief of what's possible. And then you come to some asymptotic point in that curve where you realize everyone has overestimated what's possible either right then with the technology or that will ever be possible with the technology. And you go into the, what they call like the pit of despair or the pit of disillusionment. And so you kind of just like disappear off this cliff. So you can imagine you kind of like build relatively rapidly up the curve, an asymptote, and you come pretty much straight off that cliff down into the kind of pit of despair, which, you know, in crypto was like February 2022 through to middle of 2023. And then now you've had this kind of like wiggly line of rebuilding, and like it's anyone's guess whether they'll actually build value behind them. But you then kind of build over time.
I hope so.
What do they call that? I think it's the like build of usefulness or something. So essentially like all of the tourists go home, and the people who are like super committed to the technology then kind of iterate over time and actually build something useful out of it. And so that kind of wave that you go on, appropriately identifying where you are on that curve, obviously it's really excellent to be investing when the technology just came out, a la Vinod Khosla investing in OpenAI, you know, when they were an idea. Whereas right now, where you might be investing in OpenAI at a $150 billion valuation, might be somewhere kind of maybe near the top of that hype curve. And I think the big question for a lot of investors that I'm speaking to at the moment is like, are we getting close to that? You know, and I think Sequoia wrote a really interesting piece a year ago and then rewrote another interesting piece recently on whether AI, like an infrastructure that we've put in place, can generate, I think it was $600 billion in revenue, right? So like the valuation that we have already, we've paid, the kind of aggregate of all of the infrastructure that we've put in place.
AI companies.
AI. Well, I don't think it's all of the AI companies. I think it's the infrastructure. So I think it's like NVIDIA and the underlying LLMs. I don't think that they were taking into account the app layer, but edit me there if that's not accurate. But essentially, they said with the valuation that we've got in place for that to return a reasonable return, these collection of infrastructure and kind of NVIDIA and the underlying LLMs have to generate in some kind of reasonable timeline, $600 billion of revenue. And so the open question is, can they? That's a lot of revenue. Like OpenAI, I think there's some indication OpenAI by itself is at 5. I believe Anthropic is the current front runner in terms of adoption.
And in what time schedule though?
I mean, the standard VC cycle, right? 5 to 10 years.
7 to 10.
5 to 10 years. Okay, 7 to 10. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Potentially.
Crazier things have happened?
Crazier things. I think.
Have they?
Yeah.
I would need to understand a bit more about that data. Like, okay, so 600 million across how many companies?
Billion.
Yeah.
And is it just
billion.
Billions of companies?
No, $600 billion, not 600 million.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Oh, okay. They said 600 million. I'm like, poof. OpenAI like blew that out of the water in the first 12 months. $600 billion.
No. But like how many across how many companies? And yeah, we're talking about like 7 to 10 years. And like if we think about the predictability of like how the human workforce can just like triple 5x productivity. Like, I mean, I'm an eternal optimist. I'm seeing for anyone who isn't for anyone who isn't on video right now and seeing Maxine's facial expression, she's like, maybe Cheryl.
Maxine's basically in the corner going, what?
No, I think I do not have a clear answer for this, right? If this was like a clear cut and dried, there are so many other people that are much smarter on this topic that I feel like if it was like obvious, they would have, you know, no one would be backing these LLMs. OpenAI would not be raising $150 billion. Sorry. I don't know how much they're raising, actually, but on $150 billion valuation.
Are we mixing up our billions and millions again, Maxine?
It's all blur.
No, it's a huge amount, but it's also a huge investment that people are putting in. But it wouldn't be crazy to get a huge amount out of that. It's basically being used in almost everything now. And I know, you know, I know we'll get to we'll talk about it more. But it's crazier things have happened, I believe, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question for me, especially with open source, right, and open source models, like what does this look like in the long term, right? With Llama, I know the Mozilla team are really kind of pounding the drum for open source models. If you look at the graph of adoption, the open source models are growing much faster than, you know, the closed source models. Like, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, the open source models, they are really, really a lot bigger in size. And I wonder what that actually, I'm interested in seeing how that trend continues. I mean, open source has always been very, very, very important in AI. So I don't see that going away. But it's interesting how we're now splitting things out into, you've got these proprietary models and then you've got the open models. So yeah, it's a very interesting time now, I think, that we're sitting in.
Yeah, it's an important point to pull out. I mean, you have a deep tech background. You built a computer vision business like 10 years ago. You've been in the AI space for a really long time. I'm wondering kind of from your vantage point, what has changed?
Oh my goodness. So much has changed. It's crazy when I think about that was over 10 years ago. And particularly back then in Australia, people, and I say this very generally, people didn't really see the use for AI. It wasn't of particular interest. And all of our customers were in the US. What I will say is they were all very forward-thinking organizations. They were all, still are today, all very working with cutting-edge technology. And so you really couldn't spin anything up out of the box just off of an AWS instance. You know, for example, like you can now, it wasn't the nice days that we have now, which is just, you know, you can really, really easily build or put AI into anything you're building as well. It was all very new to be using AI in a commercial setting rather than a research setting. AI, computer vision, machine learning, you know, AI is an umbrella term for so many things, but that has been around for decades and decades and decades. So this is not new. This is just new in commercial settings. Of course, there were people that were doing it, but nothing like we see today. So I think there's things that have changed and there's things that have changed slightly. So one of the trends that I see, actually, I was reading an article today, which was really timely for this podcast. And one of the fears that still exists now that I was always being asked about was, are robots going to take over our jobs? And I was looking at this post today on AI tools. So it was, you know, just a generic, hey, here are 10 other AI tools you can use apart from ChatGPT. Cool. And a number of comments, are about 50% of people saying, we shouldn't have these, they're ruining our lives, all of this, da da da. And then the other 50% of people are saying, they're making our lives better. Oh, I'm so busy. I use ChatGPT every day. I use this every day. I use beautiful AI. I use whatever. And we're basically singing praise on AI and what it's done for them in their day-to-day lives. And it's so fascinating because there's still what we sort of see is, I don't know how much, I haven't looked at the, you know, the actual data on how many people in the population versus how many agree with AI or disagree with AI being used. But from what I'm seeing is there's definitely still this huge divide. I think that it's getting smaller. The divide is shrinking. So we are accepting AI more so into our lives than we were 10 years ago when I was trying to sell an AI product. People were like, why are you doing this? Why would you ever do this? Those were the questions I was getting. I remember being interviewed and I was like, well, why are you doing this? And why are you taking people's jobs and all of these sorts of things? And you know, I think we're getting less and less of that, obviously, as we progress and as we move on and as there's more awareness around it and it's used day to day in everything we do almost.
Yeah, you know, it's gotten mainstream when my mom is using it for knitting tips.
That's the measure that you use.
Yes.
Sell.
She's like, have you heard of this like ChatGPT thing? I asked it to suggest knitting patterns. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Incredible.
You just made something that I loved uncool.
Right.
It's like you on Facebook all over again.
That would be a really interesting stat to know, like, how many people, what percentage of the population, broken down by country, uses AI consciously. Like, it's not like baked into a product that they're using, but like consciously uses AI once a day. I would venture a guess, but this might just be reflective of the ecosystem.
It's probably higher than you'd think.
Yeah, I think it would be pretty high.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like 50%.
Will you think globally?
No. Like, I reckon there'd be many places where that wouldn't be the case yet, but like US, Australia, Canada.
Yeah, like they don't even have the internet.
We're now just trying to guess data. We're just trying to guess data and like...
Yeah, super scientific. This is what you do. You just like pontificate and make predictions as a result. True.
What do you think? 50%? 40%?
Why not? That's super interesting. But I do... We hosted an event. We do a bunch of like closed door events for our LPs, VPs and portfolio. Trying to get really interesting folks to come in and like share what they see from the front. Kind of... their view from the frontier of technology. And we hosted one last night and there was some really interesting perspectives shared about like, if you're not using it already in your business today, you are already so far behind. Like if not just in your product, but like in the operations of your business, in the day-to-day operations. And so the person that was speaking to us, she runs a big company in the US and she lives in Australia. And so she was sharing that she was like, what? It's amazing to me that the Australian ecosystem, business ecosystem, not tech necessarily, but business ecosystem still seems to be picking up like, hey, we should probably use this product. And she's like, I'm doing work with folks in the US where like, you know, they're showing, and I think actually Bain came out with a really interesting report recently about the jagged edge of technology, i.e. like the number of people are using it and how they're using it. And they're like the amount of productivity it's driving for people, like the amount of scale that they're getting, also not just productivity as in terms of like sheer number of output, but also the quality of the output, right? Some indication that if you have a senior skilled person and a junior skilled person, you can actually, and you give that junior skilled person like OpenAI or Claude or any of the like major models, they're like almost next to each other. So what used to take like a decade and a half of, I can, let me tell you, as a junior lawyer, like grueling training to the wee hours of the morning in like eye-wateringly boring stuff, like it closes that gap nearly immediately. It's quite like an outrageous statement for, you know, the productivity of our population. And I think it's fairly obvious, like lots of people, if they don't adopt it, like they will become redundant. But the alternative there is if they do adopt it, they become like 10x more productive or 10x more efficient. And more importantly, like probably 10x more enjoyable. I can guarantee you it is much more enjoyable to be a partner at a law firm than a junior lawyer whose whole job is like copying and pasting shit from one box to the other box, trying really hard not to create a typo. Like that is a great way to suck the soul out of someone.
So according to the random Google search that I just did, apparently 55% of Americans are using AI regularly. So we were close. We said 50.
Yeah. Turns out I should just forget research. I'm just going to like guess stats and publish them.
Just say what you think and then just be like, yeah, that's the stat now. That's it.
I mean, arguably that is what ChatGPT does. It just says what it thinks and then it tells you, you should probably check that.
You should probably check if that's real or not.
I love it. So for those folks who don't come from a tech background, don't come from a highly kind of detail-oriented or like deeply expert AI background, do you have any tips and tricks for them as they are thinking about skilling up in this space so that they feel comfortable to invest in the space?
Yeah, I think probably the greatest advice for areas in which I'm not as strong in. I mean, obviously AI is an area in which I am a subject matter expert. But I think about other areas and I'm like, oh, I don't know that area at all. What do I do? So what I do and what I would suggest for people who are, you know, looking at, you know, so much AI is in everything. And as we've been discussing, you know, unconsciously or consciously using it, The biggest tips I think are follow thought leaders. So there are particular people that I really like to follow. So in AI, in general, two of my favorites, Fei-Fei Li, for AI in general, and then Timnit Gebru for AI ethics. Two amazing thought leaders in that space. There are, you can ask ChatGPT, there are many more. And I also think there are some other shortcuts around how you can, you know, you can't just become an expert overnight, obviously, but there are some really nice shortcuts. So looking for founders, all those who have built tech teams with deep knowledge and expertise of AI, so you know it's the real deal. So they may have come from a highly technical area in one of the large companies that are doing AI, and they're trying to then build their own product. That can give you a little bit more confidence that they know what they're doing and it's not just a hype. And then even better, hopefully you have someone around you or in your team or in your network with expertise that you could call on as a subject matter expert in that space. That's what I do for investments that I do not have deep knowledge in. And those are probably like the biggest things that I do, honestly, is just keep up with the what's possible in technology implementation as well. So you don't feel like, oh, this is absolutely crazy and out there. And yeah, is it even possible to do that? I think sense checking that somewhere or with someone, or if you don't have someone, sense checking that with experts that are talking about it.
I think those are great tips. I love that.
Yeah. And Emily is volunteering to be your AI expert. So if anyone out there wants to reach out to an expert, Emily has officially put her hand up. I saw her do it. You didn't see it on video.
Yeah. I just put my hand up to do that, actually.
So Emily, one of the last questions that we love to ask investors as part of this podcast, and I'm sure you know what's coming because you've listened to a few episodes, so hopefully you've got a good answer prepped, but what is your biggest Big Kahuna's moment, a moment where you felt really brave?
Well, we'll see if I have a good answer prep. I do know because I have listened to a number of episodes. So mine is actually, I was thinking of what's relevant for the audience. I have a couple, but the major theme for me and the one I probably will talk about is when my company was acquired, I was obviously acqui-hired in and, you know, moved into that business, doing what I know day in, day out, sort of those types of things. And then a sure pay, you know, a sure thing, a payday, you know, get my check. And then what I sort of really wanted to do was start angel investing, and I wanted to start helping other startups. And so I, rather than sort of hanging around and doing what I knew and what I felt really comfortable doing, was I moved out of that space entirely and I moved into angel investing and helping other startups. And I spent a lot of time with my portfolio companies on how do you build the business up to be successful after all I'd learned. And I wanted to use all of those learnings for something. And even though I love AI and I love computer vision and I love machine learning and I love that space, I don't sit in that space anymore, right, day to day. So I moved out of it entirely to focus on investing and focus on helping other companies. And I think that was me just pushing out of a safe sort of, hey, I have a job, I have money, you know, I have this coming in. And so, but now I'm actually going to push myself to do something I really want to do, but that is unknown to me, because at that time it was completely unknown to me. So there's a couple of times I've done that in my life. And that's, I think, the one that probably resonates with the audience the most. But the first one, which I'll quickly touch on because I know we're running out of time, was I won a scholarship type thing for university. I was one of six in Australia and it was amazing. And they supplemented the cost of my university degree and they provided me with a job as a junior engineer. And I did that for less than a year before I left to go work on my startup full time. No money, no backup plan, just fully taking that risk and believing in myself. And so I think that's like a common theme with a lot of us in this industry, you know, and I know that, you know, both, all three of us have done that at some stage in our life. And so I think, you know, that bravery of actually pushing through a sure thing, or what is, you know, quote unquote, a sure thing, into that completely unknown that you really believe in.
100%. It's so important.
Yeah, 100%.
I love that.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Emily. This has been actually one of my favorite conversations. I feel like we've had so many laughs, ended on a great note.
Do you say that to everyone though?
We do not, actually.
Now you're going to have to. You're going to have, like, from here on out, you're going to be like, this is the best every time.
Okay, well, no, we don't always say that. But we do have some great conversations, and this was absolutely one of them. So really thank you and appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you so much.
I'm Lucy.
I'm Kerry, and welcome to Mumbition, the podcast. We chat with incredible women sharing the hilarious, messy, and brilliant truth about mixing motherhood and chasing dreams.
Because building a business while building Lego empires, not always easy, but definitely possible.
So grab a coffee, probably reheated, tune in, and join our community of women who get it.
Mumbition, the podcast for mums daring enough to do both. Unapologetically.
Available now wherever you squeeze podcasts into your day.